In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, how to lower high cortisol, the groundbreaking high-fat endurance study, what causes low HRV, cardio before weights or weights before cardio, and much more.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Speed. Mobility. Balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now. On the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
So, Ben, you've got the world's toughest mudder happening this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling about it?
Yeah. Well, let me give you a little bit of an idea of what my home looks like right now. I have a crap load of gear. It looks like I'm like moving to Timbuktu or like the far reaches of Siberia right now. So on my kitchen table, let me just go through my pack list with you. Sleeping bag, blankets, thermal silver blankets, knee sleeves, bottles, sunscreen, three pairs of shoes, three pairs of socks, three pairs of liners, chamois cream, windbreaker, thermal vest, bulk water, electrolytes, tights, gloves, two headlamps, extra batteries, blister treatment, hand and foot warmers, towels, band-aids, anti-chafing cream, portable phone charger, wetsuit, hoodie, alcohol wipes, antiseptic spray, Sharpie, zip ties, lip balm, trash bags, knee pad, gaiters for shoes, goggles, and a few other random items. And we didn't even get into all of the nutrition that I'm bringing. So it is quite a chore to pack for this thing.
Insane. Oh my gosh. So will you actually be sleeping?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh no.
So why the sleeping bag?
Absolutely not. For my wife.
Oh.
Yeah. She's my Sherpa.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And if any of our listeners either have no clue what the world's toughest mudder is, or if you want to follow all the action, a couple of things. First of all, for those of you in the USA, on Saturday morning, I'll be texting out all the links and everything to track the race. And you can text the word fitness to 411-247, 411-247. And that's my free little text club that I send out little texts out. Sometimes I'll just drunk dial you on a Saturday night. Most of the time it's useful information. So you can do that. You can text fitness to 411-247 or you can check out the Facebook page because Rachel, I know you're going to be posting some stuff up on there.
Yeah, definitely. Jess is going to be sending us photos. Mm-hmm. So we'll be posting them on Instagram and Facebook. And we're going to be posting the link to live follow the race the morning of.
Quite epic. I'll be going for 90 plus miles.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, speaking of which, let's talk about cortisol, etc., shall we?
News flashes.
So, Rachel, you were not a podcast co-host / sidekick when I went through this protocol, but basically 2 years ago, I followed a high-fat, ketogenic, 90% plus fat diet for 12 months, and then I went into a lab at University of Connecticut where I ran on a treadmill for 3 hours, and they cut muscle using biopsy out of my thighs to and did a ton of blood work to analyze what happens when you follow a low-carb, high-fat diet for an extended period of time to your fuel utilization during exercise. So the cool thing is people have been asking me so much what happened, what are the study results? Well, the study just came out.
Wow.
It's actually really, really interesting. The concept that a diet that's high in carbohydrate is necessary for optimizing your exercise performance is something that's been around since the 60s.
Yep.
And basically what happened was back in the 60s, they discovered that muscle glycogen depletion, so exhaustion of your muscles, carbohydrate stores was associated with fatigue. And they also found out that a high carb diet maintains that muscle glycogen and maintains that performance. And so now here we are decades later, and there's tons of evidence that has accumulated that supports consuming carbohydrate before, during, and after exercise. It's kind of like one of the fueling paradigms that we follow in a range of sports, you know, from hockey to soccer to marathoning to the world's toughest mudder, you name it. So the idea here is that there actually is no zero essential requirement for dietary carbohydrate, because the human body actually has this really cool capacity to adapt to low carb availability. So what that means is that when you are starved, or when your glycogen levels significantly decrease, or when carbohydrates are not available, you produce what's called hepatic ketone production. Hepatic ketone production. So production of ketones by your liver, that increases dramatically to displace glucose as your brain's primary energy source. And then what happens is fatty acids supply the majority of energy for skeletal muscle. How can this occur? Well, basically it comes down to a combination of lactic acid that you produce and also the glycerol backbone of fats being burnt by muscle as a fuel. Basically, you create your own carbohydrate when you don't have an exogenous source of carbohydrate. You have little carbohydrate producing machineries in your body that make glucose.
Right.
So basically, they took us into the lab to see exactly what happens to the body when you do restrict carbohydrates. Can you actually achieve just as good performance, and what else happens? Well, the paper is very long. But it's not that hard to read. It's not that propeller hat-ish.
And okay.
I will link to it in the show notes. I'm going to keep it a mystery.
And
potentially I may do a full-on podcast with the lead researcher in the study, Dr. Jeff Volek. But essentially what it comes down to is the researchers, they really kind of rewrote the textbooks when it comes to fat burning and carb burning. And I would especially challenge anyone who is very interested in carbs, ketone production, and how the body actually produces energy from fat, even in the absence of carbohydrate, go read the discussion section of this particular study. It's all free. The discussion section is actually quite enlightening, if that's the correct word to use. And if you want a little bit of fun reading over the weekend, check it out. We'll link to it in the show notes over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/338. All right, next up, speaking of cardiovascular exercise and ungodly amounts of time spent on a treadmill or doing loops of the world's toughest mudder, another study came out that is the first study that's been out in a long time that looks at like the whole cardio versus weights. Versus weights versus cardio. Did I just use the word versus too many times?
Too many times. Yeah, you did. That's okay. We'll forgive you.
Yeah. So I get this question a lot, especially when it comes to fat loss. Do you do the cardio first or the weights first?
Mm-hmm.
And up until this point, the research that existed was primarily done by the Journal of Strength and Conditioning, or appeared in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning. And what it showed was that order didn't seem to matter. So most of the studies at this point were done in inactive, sedentary people. And the particular research study that was the biggest one done up to this point was done about a year and a half ago. And they put these two different sets of ladies through 8 weeks of exercise, in which they either did endurance first or strength first. And they found that ultimately it doesn't matter whether you do strength or cardio first if your goal is just fat loss.
Okay.
But this most recent study, in which they looked at overweight men, found that when comparing cardio versus strength versus cardio, there I did it again. What happens when they looked at leptin, which is a marker of appetite and fat burning regulation, and they looked at testosterone, they looked at cortisol, they looked at body fat, they found there wasn't a really significant difference for cortisol. Or for testosterone. But what they did find was that both groups experienced a significant decrease in body fat, and the weights before cardio, weightlifting before cardio, they came off slightly better in the fat loss category.
How slight is slightly?
And actually, it wasn't super significant, but it was enough to test for significance in the actual study. So ultimately, if your goal is weight loss purely, you're going to be better off doing weightlifting first, like warming up, doing your weightlifting, and then doing the cardiovascular exercise after, probably because the weightlifting depletes some of your muscle glycogen stores, and then you turn to fatty acids to utilize during the cardio. You know, if you were to do like a series of weightlifting sets followed by, let's say, 20 minutes on a bike or a treadmill or something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, though, when it comes to both of these studies, they were done in inactive, sedentary, overweight people. And so we can't necessarily extrapolate this to active populations, but there was one other study that was done way back in 2008, back when I was knee-high to a grasshopper, or however that phrase goes. Is that how it goes, knee-high to a grasshopper?
I'm not sure, but
I don't remember.
2008.
Back in 2008. And what they found was that in more active people, combining strength and cardio during the same workout, meaning doing like a set of back-to-back strength exercises, let's say overhead press to a squat, followed by a brief burst of cardio, like 30 to 60 seconds of jumping rope, and then going back into back-to-back strength exercises, back to a cardio burst, so to speak, is superior when it comes to fat loss to just doing weights or just doing cardio. So ultimately, what it looks like here is in overweight women, it doesn't seem to matter. In overweight men, weights before cardio seems to matter. And in active people, mixing it all up in one big jumble seems to be the best solution for fat loss.
There you go.
Yeah. But obviously, fat loss is not like necessarily the holy grail for people.
Right.
For example, if your goal is really good biomechanics and getting as strong as possible, you should definitely do your weights first before you're exhausted by cardio. But if you're, say, a runner who's really working on form and efficiency and economy, you don't want to go running after you've done a bunch of like deadlifts or squats.
Right.
So in a case like that, you separate the two, or you do cardio before weights. So ultimately, that's the skinny on the cardio and the weights. And then the last thing I wanted to mention was a buyer beware warning about probiotics. They did this study on probiotics to see if the probiotics were antibiotic resistant, which is really interesting. And I'm not quite sure if it's that meaningful for folks to know if their probiotics are antibiotic resistant, unless they're, I guess, taking probiotics and antibiotics simultaneously. And even then, it doesn't really matter if the probiotics are antibiotic resistant, because you wouldn't want to kill them anyways. But more meaningful on this particular study, and I'll link to the study in the show notes, was the fact that as part of the study, they evaluated whether or not these probiotics even had all of the strains in them that they claimed to have in them. So
what probiotics were they testing?
There were five different strains from a variety of different manufacturers. They didn't list the actual manufacturers, but they tested five different brands of probiotics. And they looked at all the different strains, like Lactobacillus and Saccharomyces boulardii and all these different, you know, strange names that they give to the bacteria in the probiotics that you can never pronounce, but that are actually on the label of most yogurts, if you turn over the label. And what they found was that most of the yogurt manufacturers, the probiotic manufacturers, when you look at the parts per billion or million of probiotics that they claim to have, they fell far short. And some of them barely contained any live bacteria whatsoever in terms of viable active bacteria. Which means that not only are most of the good bacteria dead before they even get to your small intestine, they're dead before you even open the package. It's very important when you're getting probiotics that you pay attention to whether or not it was heated or heat stable, if it's a spore-forming probiotic. There's a lot of considerations when it comes to probiotics.
So is it worth buying them at all?
I think your best bet is A, to get dirty, meaning avoid antibacterial hand soaps, avoid frequent showering with lots of soap, get out in nature, have pets, spend time with kids, expose yourself to a wide variety of bacteria, fermented foods, kimchi, kombucha. I think chocolate is a fermented food too.
Yay.
Yeah. And then when it comes to probiotics, you know, what I do is I use them when I travel because I don't have access to a lot of fermented foods, and I'll either use a soil-based organism. There's one called Prescriptacyst, for example. There's another one that I recently talked about on Facebook because we did like a little giveaway and promo of this stuff called Black Water, and that's also like water with soil-based organisms in it, and they sell a powder too. But that's one option, is soil-based organisms. The other is heat-stable spore-forming probiotics, and that would be, for example, the advanced caprobiotics is one. We've got a few of them at Greenfield Fitness Systems because I evaluate pretty rigorously whether or not there are actual studies that show that the bacteria are alive when they hit your gut. And the ones I have at Greenfield Fitness Systems, I'll vouch for. But one is the Exos probiotic. Another one is Caprobiotics Advanced. And then you've got like these soil-based organisms, which are basically the equivalent of going out in your backyard and licking dirt, but with none of the pucker factor. So anyways, what it comes down to is don't just freaking use any old probiotic, you know, off the counter. And by the way, a shout out to my friend Rich Roll. I noted that he recently had a fantastic interview on the microbiome and the gut on his podcast. And so I don't remember which number it is, but if you go listen to Rich Roll's recent podcast on the benefits of getting dirty and the germ and the microbiome, he's got some good information on there too. He interviewed a physician for a couple of hours and it was quite good. So there you go. There's everything that you need to know about bacteria.
And you can receive these news flashes and more, including a bunch of awesome giveaways every single day, if you follow Ben at twitter.com/BenGreenfield, instagram.com/BenGreenfieldFitness, and facebook.com/BGFitness. Sorry for all of the different URLs.
Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full-spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just 2 bottles. I keep them in my pantry. Throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
Shall we jump into the Q&A?
Let's do it.
All right.
Listener Q&A.
Hey there, it's Dean from Australia. I got a question about cortisol. I'm a master's athlete. I'm a road cyclist, and I have a pretty high stress job. And I'm got one of those, I guess, wound up personalities as well. So, last couple of years, I've been in a cycle of everything going great. Then I get sick, kind of reset, start again, train, get sick, reset, start again. And I've had a conversation with a good physiotherapist recently who was talking about his experience with elevated cortisol levels and particularly the impact that stress and lifestyle and caffeine can have on cortisol, and the end result being the suppressed immune system and getting sick. So I do pretty much everything right in terms of nutrition and I try to sleep well. But, yeah, I guess I'm just wondering your thoughts on elevated cortisol and the impact it can have on getting sick while very fit, and what can be done naturally to work around that, and particularly the role that caffeine may have, because I'm a bit of a caffeine junkie. Thanks, guys. Loving the show.
Dean, it sounds like a cousin of yours, mm-hmm. Rachel.
He's my bro from another Mo.
That's right. It's the way you say it over the land of Oz.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can speak a little Oz. So anyways, cortisol. This is a topic near and dear to my heart because I have personally struggled a bit with hypercortisolism many times on blood tests that I've done. And for me, it's related to an active lifestyle. Mm. What I mean by that is I live pretty low stress. I love my relationships.
Yeah.
I shave with great shaving equipment.
You live in a beautiful home that's been fully detoxed.
I'm surrounded by nature and I don't get a lot of Wi-Fi and stuff like that. But I do send my body to hell and back almost every day with the workout.
Like this weekend.
I've got tough workouts. And then at least every few weeks, I'm doing something that scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
When it comes to just like putting my body through the ringer. And no matter how healthy you are, how much you sleep, how good your diet is, how good your relationships are, et cetera. Even something as simple as just pushing your body above and beyond what our hunter-gatherer, farmer ancestors would have done when it comes to low-level physical activity throughout the day, that can dump a lot of cortisol into your body. And it's just this uphill battle athletes always have to follow. It's the reason that I will probably, after the world's toughest mudder, be taking a good month at some point, just super duper easy.
Chilling out. Yeah.
Yoga, sitting in the grass in my backyard, staring off into space, petting a goat, holding a chicken, just basically
taking some CBD.
That's right. So, anyways, yeah, big old long blade of grass sticking out of my mouth, chewing on that with my farmer's hat on. Anyways, though, yes. So cortisol is something that we all have to deal with a little bit. And just kind of a couple quick things on cortisol. I know that most of you could just like go to the Wikipedia page for cortisol and learn exactly what it is and what it does. But before we jump into caffeine and cortisol and also cortisol in the immune system, basically cortisol is what's called a glucocorticoid. It's also known as hydrocortisone, which is why when you get a cortisone injection, sometimes you get super stressed out and you grit your teeth and you're up all night. You know, for those people who have gotten like injections in their knees, for example, or on other swollen joints, because it just dumps a bunch of cortisol into your body. And cortisol is produced in your adrenal cortex in response to stress. It's made from cholesterol, which is why if you're on a very, very low-fat diet or you don't have enough cholesterol, you actually can have trouble waking up in the morning because cortisol is what butts you out of bed in the morning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and we get that big peak in cortisol around 8 a.m. Ironically, coffee causes you to have a big cortisol dump. It's very strange that we drink a cortisol-inducing stimulant at the same time that our cortisol levels are naturally the highest during the day. It's kind of odd, but you know, but coffee is also a digestive. It's got antioxidants. It does some things for your brain. So, you know, there are other benefits to a morning cup of coffee, but it is a little bit strange. It seems like lunchtime, right? Or after lunch would be a better
afternoon
time
when
day.
You're like, yes, yeah. kind of
Yeah, all the research studies that have been done on coffee and its ability to restrict wakefulness or restrict sleep and restrict deep sleep patterns or deleteriously affect circadian rhythm, they've all shown that as long as you're kind of finished up with coffee by approximately 3 hours before bedtime, it's not that big of a deal. But I have always thought it strange that we drink coffee, you know, as a society at the same time that we are already producing our natural wakefulness hormone. So cortisol helps you deal with stress, which is great. So for example, it stimulates gluconeogenesis, which basically is the making of new glucose, specifically in your liver. So cortisol actually uses amino acids, lactic acid, glycerol, and something called propionate to create glucose in your liver. And then what happens is it also causes glycogenolysis. So at the same time that it helps your liver to make new glucose, it also helps you to break down glycogen that's stored in your liver and your muscle cells, and that puts glucose into your bloodstream, which you can use to run from the lion. So it also inhibits insulin from shuttling glucose into cells. So it keeps glucose hanging around out in cells, so you can just access it a little bit more readily when it comes to needing to fight stress. Now, that's what cortisol does from an energetic standpoint, but it affects other things too, like bone and muscle. So cortisol inhibits the uptake of amino acids into muscle cells, which means that if your cortisol is very, very high for too long, it can be very difficult to fuel muscles because you've already got cortisol lowering insulin. And at the same time, you've got cortisol inhibiting the uptake of other nutrients into muscle cells. So your muscles have a very hard time getting both amino acids as well as glucose when you have high levels of cortisol. It also inhibits, again, in excess, it inhibits bone formation and decreases calcium absorption in your intestines. So both your muscles and your bones can suffer from elevated excess cortisol. Yeah. A few other things that it does, it actually increases your sensitivity to epinephrine and also to norepinephrine. And what that means is it causes vasorestriction or reduced blood flow in many parts of your body, primarily so you can shunt blood flow to your core to help you to survive. And so in many cases, you'll get like increased blood pressure, for example, especially because cortisol also serves as an antidiuretic. So it causes your body to retain sodium. And this is why high blood pressure is one of those things that, of course, we know goes hand in hand with high amounts of stress or high amounts of cortisol.
Right.
Now, there are go ahead.
Oh, no, I've got my propeller hat on and I'm okay. Just piecing together all of the information.
Yeah, because I really want to, I don't know if I've really gone into everything that cortisol does before on a podcast.
This is juicy.
I've got very low levels of T3. I showed this on the recent blood test that I went through my entire blood panel on a recent blog post at bengreenfieldfitness.com so that all the world could see how effed up my body is. It's actually not that bad, but there were two areas that were a little bit affected deleteriously by the amount of primarily physical stress that I put my body through. One is T3, and one major reason for that is cortisol can interfere with the production of thyroid hormones, and specifically, even if your thyroid gland is producing adequate T4, which is a precursor to T3, high amounts of cortisol inhibit the conversion of T4 to T3. The other thing that happens is cortisol can shut down the production of testosterone because the human body does not want to create babies in a time of famine, stress, running from lions, etc. So sex hormone binding globulin, which binds to total testosterone and causes it to not be able to be available in its free active form, is something that gets increased, again, in response to high amounts of cortisol. So you've got basically shutting down of the reproductive system and shutting down of the thyroid and the metabolic system.
Now, when you say high cortisol, is it kind of like chronically high cortisol, mm-hmm. like over an extended period of time?
Over an extended period of time, exactly.
So how long do you think that would be?
It varies from person to person because genetically, if your ancestors were a very hardy population, you'll find that, and then I'm just going to throw a population out here. I'm not saying this to be like racist or or anything like that. But let's say you're like Jewish, right? You come from a lineage that has been exposed to high amounts of stress, wars, famine, lots of moving, nomadic lifestyles, etc. And you would be able to handle a higher amount of cortisol for a higher period of time if genetically that is your lineage, at least theoretically. Like that's the way that it would work. Whereas I don't know if you're a big fat Samoan islander whose ancestors sat around playing the ukulele and eating coconuts.
I can't believe that's what you think Samoans do. Samoans are hard asses. They make up the majority of every rugby team.
I love all our Samoan listeners. But anyway, so the answer is it really does truly depend. You know those people. Like my wife, for example, comes from this hard Montana rancher line, right? And she can go all day, whereas I need a nap. Just different strokes for different folks. So the other interesting thing, because I've also struggled in the past with gut issues, and I know a lot of our listeners do have this issue as well, but cortisol causes an increase in gastric acid production. And when this occurs chronically, that can lead to things like acid reflux, and it can cause other problems in your small intestine, and the decreased blood flow from the increased sensitivity to epinephrine and norepinephrine. Part of the decreased blood flow is to your GI tract. Your body doesn't want to digest food when you're stressed out. And so that can cause incredible problems with digestion, constipation, lack of nutrient absorption, a lot of other issues that people have to deal with. And again, I know for me personally, the more stressed out I am, the more I deal with things like gut issues or having to spend a long amount of time on the toilet. You know, just things that you would think would you know, you kind of know theoretically that they're responses to stress, but there are actually biological things happening in your body, like decreased enzyme production, decreased hydrochloric acid production, decreased blood flow to the intestine that causes those issues. Sympathetic nervous system activation, you know, when pooping and digesting is all parasympathetic nervous system activation. So, so basically, I'm hoping I've convinced folks enough that you do not want to necessarily have chronically elevated cortisol levels. So there were basically two things that Dean asked about, the effects of caffeine on cortisol and also the effects of cortisol on the immune system.
Right.
So the main thing with immunity is that if you're stressed out, you do get sick more easily because high amounts of cortisol suppress your T cells. And these are important immune cells responsible for causing your immune system to be able to fight off infections, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You'll find a lot of times in people who are exercising chronically a very, very low white blood cell count. And this can go hand in hand with that low T cell count. And it's a kind of a good 1-2 combo for not being able to fight off infections very easily. Now, granted, there are things that you can take to naturally increase white blood cell production or to improve your immunity. So, for example, chaga mushroom extract is one that I've talked about before as a really, really good way to improve the activity of your immune system. Astragalus is an herbal extract that's also very good for the immune system. You'll also you'll see everything from like echinacea to elderberry, to vitamin C as things that can help out in a case of low immune function. Some of those actually have research behind them. Some of them are, you know, alternative medical remedies that don't have a great deal of research, but a lot of anecdotal evidence. You know, people who, you know, I know for me, when I use elderberry and when I use vitamin C, I use chaga, I use a little bit of oregano if I've been around sick people or I feel a sickness coming on. And it does help quite a bit. I used to get sick all the time. I just don't anymore. Mm. So that's one thing when it comes to cortisol and you know, chronic exercise, et cetera, in general, especially endurance exercise seems to cause us a little bit more than strength-based exercise. You do get a suppression of the immune system. And those are some of the things that you can do about it. When it comes to coffee, you know, that you have to take into consideration some of the things that I talked about already, you know, the fact that in the morning you're already producing a bunch of cortisol, but caffeine has been shown to stimulate cortisol production. That is undeniable. And they've also found, this was a study in the Journal of Psychosomatic Medicine back in 2005, they've found that regular coffee drinking can actually increase your tolerance to the effect of caffeine to induce a cortisol spike. And so what this means is that this is probably The increase in cortisol is probably more of an issue for A, people who are drinking coffee few and far between and finding that, you know, if they're stressed out and you don't drink coffee very much, you shouldn't drink coffee if you're stressed, period. If you're a habitual coffee drinker, it may have a little bit less of a cortisol stimulating effect. So that's one thing to bear in mind. And then the other thing is that, you know, part of this is, of course, the doses and the poison, and small amounts of coffee are probably not as big of an issue as the folks who are drinking 3, 4, 5 cups of coffee during the day, and especially drinking coffee in the evenings. So, you know, that's the main thing.
That's a funny little cycle. If you drink more coffee, you decrease your response to it increasing your cortisol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you need to drink less coffee in order to stop in the first place.
Yeah, but that's the deal with coffee in general. We become tolerant to its wakefulness effects. We become tolerant to its cortisol-inducing effects. Frankly, just, you know, unfortunately, coffee just does less for you, period.
The more you drink it,
You drink it. But, you know, one of the things that coffee does do, and this is interesting, is it has a peristaltic effect, meaning that it can induce a bowel movement in the morning. And I know that a lot of people use it just for that, to be able to, you know, go to the bathroom. And
is that why you use it, Ben? Because we all know how much you love pooping.
You know what? First of all, I am now almost...
Let's get deep into it.
I'm almost 17 days into no coffee, no alcohol.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How's it going?
Oh, I'm going to have 8 freaking shots of espresso and a margarita after that world's toughest mutter. I can tell you right now. It's actually going quite well. I feel great. And oddly enough, I've actually been a little bit hungrier when I wake up in the morning, because I think I'm consuming like 150 to 200 fewer calories in the evening from like a glass of wine. And I didn't really put anything else in to replace those calories. And so it's interesting. Yeah. I had never really thought about how much those calories from alcohol add up. And then the coffee, you know what? I'm on, like, I'm doing green tea with a little bit of chaga mushroom, speaking of chaga. And you know, I feel fine.
But how's the morning poop?
The morning poo doesn't seem to have been deleteriously affected. But again, I am drinking a nice big hot warm beverage of green tea. So that may be replacing some of the effects of coffee. And granted, green tea also has a little bit of caffeine, theanine in it. So that's the deal with coffee and caffeine and the immune system and cortisol. So ultimately, I really haven't given Dean that many solutions. And so I just want to tell you a couple of things real quick. I'm going to put all of these references in the show notes for you over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/338. If you do struggle with high cortisol, some of the best things that you can do. First of all, I've got an article called 7 of the Best Ways to Stop Stress. I will link to this in the show notes for you. I'm not going to get into a ton of detail on this, but the primary stress-reducing activities, because there are a ton of them, but the ones that have been shown to have the most beneficial effect on reducing cortisol and have been shown in clinical studies to reduce salivary levels of cortisol... one would be breathing. Okay. Mm-hmm. There are baroreceptors in your chest that respond to shallow chest breathing and produce cortisol in response to that.
It's so incredible that something so fundamental could have such a profound effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just breathe deeply. Yeah.
Deep diaphragmatic nasal breathing, and turning that into a daily habit. That's why I love starting off your day with yoga, because you set that habit, you set that pattern. You know, and I start off every day with 10 to 15 minutes of yoga, just so I do a lot of this deep nasal breathing.
And I also find that when you get used to breathing that way, you notice when your breathing then becomes quite shallow, which is a sign of being stressed, which enables you to be able to actually tell when you're stressed and minimize it.
Yeah. And there's all these, like, I don't use any of the apps or like straps that you wear that'll like detect shallow chest breathing, et cetera. I just don't because I like to be a little bit more unplugged during the day. But there are tools out there that you could look into for that type of thing. And by the way, if you are listening in and you have any breathing tools that you personally like to use, let Dean know in the comments, and we can pass that information on to him. So leave a comment if you have something helpful to add. Meditation is the second thing, in addition to breathing. And obviously meditation in many cases incorporates breathing. So that'd be number two, whether it's transcendental, whether it's mindfulness meditation, whether it's, you know, moving meditation, like a very easy swim or something like that. There are a variety of ways to skin that cat, but mm-hmm. meditation, also good science behind that. Yoga, you're noticing a little bit of a pattern here.
Interesting.
All incorporate breathing, all are very light, restorative. So yoga, and also yoga's Chinese sister, I'm just making that up, Tai Chi. So either yoga or Tai Chi or both have been shown, again, to decrease salivary cortisol. There's a really good DVD called Tai Chi for Beginners. I own it, and I'll just stick that in every once in a while and watch it. It's just this old Chinese dude in like this white, cool, flowing outfit walking through these different moves, like the crane and, you know, these little animal-esque movements. Just looking very much like the old guys at the park.
Just so serene, just pure mm-hmm. serenity.
Yeah, exactly. It actually is quite calming.
Yeah.
So, neurofeedback using coherence. This is another one that you can do. And there is this technique. I'll just give you the URL. Go to heartmath.org, heartmath.org, and you can learn something called the quick coherence technique. And it's simply a matter of thinking of something that you're grateful for, something that you love, closing your eyes, placing that into your heart, breathing it into the center of your chest, taking a moment to reflect upon that, and then moving on. But you can tie that into biofeedback, meaning that at HeartMath, they have a hardware that you can purchase, and you attach a little clip to your ear, and it analyzes your heart rate variability at the same time that you're going through all these thought patterns and coherence. Mm-hmm. And you can do things like make flowers grow on a computer screen as you're learning how to consciously control your nervous system. It's pretty cool stuff.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. And so I'll link to the article in which I talk about more thoroughly about how to do that. But that would be another of the stress reducing methods. And then finally, last one I'll throw at you here. And again, check out the article for all the details on this stuff. Sleep. And that's a biggie. And what happens, it's very interesting. Yeah. A lot of times we will get very busy and throw in some exercise, throw in a new hobby, throw in some relationships, etc. Short, a little sleep here, a little sleep there, and pretty soon it adds up very quickly. Yeah. So sleep is a biggie. You know, my pattern almost every day is 7 to 8 hours of sleep each night. I'm one of those 10 p.m. to bed, 6 a.m. up kind of guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then a quick snooze after lunch. That's pretty much every day for me. And I've been putting a little bit of extra sleep in the bank this week just because I know I'm not going to be sleeping much.
This weekend.
I'll be running and jumping off cliffs in the water. And then supplements. I get a lot of questions about this. Remember, you cannot out-supplement a stressful lifestyle, but there are some things that I do recommend for anyone dealing with high levels of cortisol. I'm going to throw them out to you pretty quick here, but Chinese adaptogenic herbs like Tianqi is the one that I like. Those can help you to lower cortisol when cortisol is high, or raise it when cortisol is low. High levels of cortisol and stress do a very good job exhausting your adrenal glands of minerals. So high electrolyte intake and mineral intake via things like sea salt and liquid minerals. That's also a very good solution. You'll go through vitamin D much more quickly when you're stressed out. And so taking anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 international units of vitamin D a day. Vitamin C, your adrenals are also a storehouse for vitamin C. So anywhere again from 1,000 to 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day. And then finally, because cortisol causes a histamine release that increases inflammation, some kind of a fish oil can be quite helpful as well. These are all the type of things you'd use for adrenal stress, adrenal fatigue, etc. The very, very last resource I want to give you is the most comprehensive book I've ever read on cortisol, written by a friend of mine, Sean Talbot. It's called The Cortisol Connection Book, and just a quick read, grab it off of Amazon. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But yeah, we could obviously do a 3-hour podcast on cortisol.
Yeah.
But those are the biggies. Dean, I hope that's helpful for you. And again, if any of you are listening and you have comments or your own tips to share, go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/338 and share the love.
Hi, Ben. This is Ryan Walker. I'm from Mobile, Alabama. I love the podcast. Addicted to the podcast. Share it with everybody. I have a question that I've been dying to ask for the longest time now. My grandmother on my mother's side was a paranoid schizophrenic. When I found this out, I was absolutely terrified that I might start to display symptoms and develop schizophrenia myself. I'm 24 years old. I haven't displayed any paranoid delusions or symptoms. However, I can be paranoid at times, but I think rightfully so. I was hoping that maybe you could give me a list of things that I can stay away from, lifestyle factors to avoid any epigenetic expression, such as, you know, foods, staying away from stress. I heard that stress can be an issue, so I've tried managing stress through some TM in the mornings. I do 20 minutes of transcendental meditation, trying to manage stress that way. Another thing would be foods. I have heard, which this may be complete BS, but that cow's milk or cow, you know, cow dairy may actually contribute to the expression of that gene. So I don't know if that's true. If not, please clarify, and please just give me a list of some lifestyle factors to stay away from, or some things to even implement to mitigate the potential effects of onset schizophrenia. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is an interesting question.
Isn't it?
I don't know that we've talked that much about schizophrenia on the show, and I should point out that I am not a doctor, nor am I a psychiatrist, nor do I wear a lab coat, nor do I do frontal lobotomies on anyone, ever. Never done that. Not even on a pet. So,
So talk to your doctor.
Talk to your doctor. However, there is pretty much unanimous agreement among experts that schizophrenia develops as a result of the interplay between biological predispositions, inheriting certain genes, basically, and the kind of environment that you get exposed to.
Yes.
And so you are definitely born with, depending on parental factors, a higher risk for schizophrenia genetically, or lower risk, as the case may be. And then your epigenetic environment, or the kind of triggers that you pull from an environmental standpoint, can then further increase the risk that that genetic predisposition to schizophrenia is going to develop into it actually manifesting itself. So this is just a simple case of nature versus nurture. So, I mean, you know, for example, there was one study that, and this is not schizophrenia, this is more like aggression and criminality, but this was back in 2002. They identified this gene called the MAOA gene. And they termed this, scientists termed this the violence gene. And what they found was that it was associated with aggression and criminal activity, and that people who had this gene had a higher than normal risk of growing up to be antisocial or violent. But this was only if they were neglected or abused as children.
Right.
So if they had this violent gene, but they also had a loving, non-abusive family, they turned out just fine. So, you know, that's just, you know, one example of the nature versus nurture type of thing. With schizophrenia, you know, an example of the theory of schizophrenia, for example, there was one pretty recent research study that showed that people who have multiple copies of a version of the gene associated with schizophrenia and who smoke marijuana or use cannabis, they increase their risk of developing schizophrenia by 1,000%.
Wow.
So that would be one example of something that you should definitely avoid if you have genetic predisposition to schizophrenia. This is because of the interplay between marijuana and dopamine receptors. We just published or are about to publish a article on this from the Examine Research Digest. If you want to dig into dopamine, schizophrenia, and marijuana a little bit more, Rachel, that's going live on the Facebook page this week.
I think it might be live already.
Okay, cool.
I think
so
it's today.
If you want to read that whole article for free on dopamine, schizophrenia, and marijuana, go to facebook.com/BGFitness. That's facebook.com/BGFitness. So we know that weed is one issue when it comes to development of schizophrenia if you have a genetic predisposition to it. A lot of the research that's been done on schizophrenia, unfortunately, for our dear listener, Ryan, has been done on what the mother does while she's pregnant with you. Everything from alcohol and lead exposure causing increased risk for schizophrenia to exposure to like genital herpes during pregnancy, toxoplasmosis, which is basically, you know, like your mom having a cat, which is kind of interesting, but cats carry a toxoplasmosis gene. And they found that if your mom has exposure to that while she's pregnant with you and you have the gene for schizophrenia, it could increase your risk for developing it later on in life.
How bizarre.
I know.
That is so bizarre.
But if you Google the term cat lady schizophrenia, there actually is some evidence that women who spend a lot of time around cats who have the gene for schizophrenia tend to develop that because a lot of cats will carry this toxoplasmosis gene. I'm serious. Take the deep dive into that one on the Googles.
Gosh. So
yeah, low folic acid levels during pregnancy, low choline availability during pregnancy, like low amounts of fish oil. But I know that this is probably just kind of like a depressing topic for you if you're listening in and you aren't able to go back and like be born again. So yeah. what can Thanks you do?
Tell your mom what to do while she's pregnant with you.
Yeah, mom. So anyways, what can you do if you know that you have the gene for schizophrenia to prevent schizophrenia? In addition to avoiding marijuana, one is fish oil. They found that omega-3 fatty acids found in fish oil may lower the risk of psychotic disorders from getting worse and even prevent psychosis from occurring in the first place.
Wow.
So this is probably related to the enhanced neural function that occurs from a high intake of omega-3 fatty acids. So that's one that I would definitely look into, would be the use of essential fats and specifically omega-3 fatty acids. So, you know, the breaking down or stripping of essential fats from the brain is actually done by this enzyme called phospholipase. And phospholipase appears to be overexpressed in people who have schizophrenia, which means that schizophrenics would have lower levels of fatty acids in the frontal cortex of their brain. So using high amounts of omega-3 fatty acids, when I say high amounts, you have some people, some fitness quote-unquote experts, you know, guys like Charles Poliquin, for example, recommending like 40 plus grams of fish oil per day. I've never recommended fish oil dosages that high. But for the regular person, I recommend about 1 to 4 grams per day, depending on how much fish you're eating. And if you're looking at needing more because of a high level of turnover from something like high levels of this enzyme called phospholipase, you'd probably be closer to like 8 to 10 grams per day of fish oil. And so almost, you know, double/triple the dosages of what's normally recommended.
Yeah.
The other part of the essential fat story is that these essential fats are also prone to destruction in the brain and in the diet by oxidants. And there's also evidence that there's more oxidation in the frontal cortex of people who have schizophrenia. So not only do you want to consume these essential fats, but you want to ensure that they are not oxidized. Now, the main vitamins that tend to show that they can keep essential fatty acids from being oxidized in the human body are vitamin A, vitamin C, and vitamin E. So using like a multivitamin that has those antioxidants in them, or consuming a fish oil that's packaged with those antioxidants, there's one called Super Essentials that I like. It's called Super Essentials Fish Oil. And it's packaged with antioxidants, astaxanthin, cold processed, so it's like not prone to oxidation, and also has antioxidants with it as well. That'd be another thing. And then, of course, as you can probably guess, any form of smoking and carcinogen exposure, like, you know, barbecued meats, processed meats, smoking, any of these sources of oxidants can destroy a lot of these antioxidants more readily, especially vitamin C. So, and also lead more oxidation of these essential fatty acids. So, you know, doing a lot more like boiling, steaming, raw cooking, blending, juicing, and then avoiding cigarette smoke. And of course, marijuana smoke would be another very important thing to do in terms of reducing risk for schizophrenia. Methylation. So a faulty methylation means that you're going to develop a lot of this amino acid in your bloodstream called homocysteine. And many people with schizophrenia tend to have these very, very high levels of homocysteine, even if they're not taking in a lot of the things that can cause high homocysteine, like synthetic folic acid, such as you would find in like a cheap common multivitamin. That's going to dump a bunch of folic acid into your body, and that can get converted into homocysteine. And these high levels of homocysteine are associated with schizophrenia. It's probably because people diagnosed with schizophrenia probably also have a genetic variation of this this homocysteine lowering enzyme, which may mean that they need more of an active form of folic acid. So what this comes down to is if you have a genetic risk for schizophrenia or have schizophrenia, there's a form of folic acid called methyl tetrahydrofolate, MTHFR, methyl tetrahydrofolate. You want to look for a multivitamin that has that form of folic acid in it. Because just for anybody, not even people with schizophrenia, high levels of folic acid can cause some serious health issues. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to use a synthetic folic acid supplement like most multivitamins use nowadays. You want to use this stuff called methyl tetrahydrofolate. Methyl tetrahydrofolate. So,
and the Exos Multi that you suggest, is that kind in it?
Yeah, the one I take, the Exos, that definitely has MTHFR in it. Right. And that multivitamin was one, like I was actually on well down the path to formulating my own multivitamin using raw ingredients from a number of different manufacturers, and then realized that this company Exos, you know, like 40 miles from my house, so this at the Thorne facility in Dover, Idaho, they were already producing a multivitamin that satisfied all these criteria. And many nice. More. So that one you can find at bengreenfieldfitness.com/multi. Full disclosure, I'm on their board and I profit from that multivitamin. But there's a reason for that, because it's what I take. It's what my wife
you
takes.
Believe
it's,
in
it's,
it.
Yeah, I believe in it. So anyways, that would be another thing. And then the last thing is just food allergies. Some people with mental health problems can be very sensitive to gluten. That's primarily related to what's talked about in the book Grain Brain and the neural inflammation that very concentrated high levels of gluten can cause. Mm-hmm. And there were studies back in the 50s that showed that schizophrenic children frequently have celiac disease or severe gluten allergies. And so eliminating gluten from the diet would probably be prudent. It would probably be prudent for sure. So I'll put some of these resources in the show notes for you, Ryan. And if you have questions, you can leave them in the comments there. But those are some of the biggies that I'd start with, would be avoiding marijuana, taking some essential fatty acids, using a good multi, checking for food allergies, and then also getting some antioxidants into your system. So
there you go.
Hi, Ben. Danella from New Zealand. I have a question for you about protein powder. So I've been using the MHP paleo protein, which is a beef and egg white protein. I noticed the other day when I went to reorder it that it says it's not suitable for nursing moms. So I'm nursing my 8-month-old, and I couldn't find any information online as to why it wouldn't be suitable, and I couldn't find any information from the company themselves. Perhaps you could shed some light on this as to why I wouldn't be able to use that protein. And if you think that I shouldn't, maybe you have a suggestion for another protein that would be okay for me to use while nursing. Thanks so much. Love the show.
So, Rachel, I think Daniela is probably trying to have a big old swole muscular baby. What do you think?
That's definitely what she's going for.
She wants to have the next Arnold.
Yeah.
Governor of California, of course. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, the best way to have a large muscular baby is to consume a lot of protein powder. Well said.
While breastfeeding.
Well said baby is breastfeeding. Yes.
Right.
Of course.
Win-win.
And you should probably throw some creatine in there too. And maybe some kind of like jacked ephedra-based supplements, so they're very hyperactive and able to lift more. A little pre-workout booster for your baby. Yeah, protein. So first of all, there's nothing inherent in protein. You know, if you were to exceed 200 grams of protein per day, you'd probably get a little bit of nitrogenous buildup that might make your milk taste crappy, or, you know, put some ammonia in the milk. But that's really not a big issue unless you're just like eating a seriously large amount of man in a can while you're pregnant.
So why did the protein company say that she shouldn't use it while nursing?
So there's a couple reasons that this could be likely. First of all, I don't know if you heard about the study a couple years ago that found that most protein powders have really high naturally occurring levels of trace heavy metals. So
interestingly,
the vegan proteins tend to even have higher heavy metal counts than like the animal-based proteins like whey and whey isolate. And, you know, usually I'm a pretty good advocate of vegan-based proteins, like Living Protein is the one that I use. But there can be some metals in these, just naturally high levels of metals. So you may want to be careful from that perspective. And you can contact just about any manufacturer and ask for a certificate of analysis of heavy metal contamination and testing. But if you aren't able to get that, you may want to be careful with protein powder while breastfeeding because of that. So in most folks, it's very, very trace levels. It's not that much. It was kind of blown out of proportion, the study, but it is something to know if you're breastfeeding, especially because babies are little.
And metals
are going to
affect them. They're vulnerable.
They're very vulnerable, especially to metals.
And they're growing.
And we won't even get into the vaccine discussion at this point.
We want to help them develop.
As we talk about metals. Sweeteners. So saccharin, sucralose, acesulfame, potassium, etc. Not only if you're pregnant, can a lot of that cross the placenta and could remain in fetal tissue, but it can also wind up in breast milk. And we still don't know a lot about how fully these are metabolized. And there is some evidence that they can cause some damage to, for example, bacteria, you know, specifically potentially your gut bacteria. Granted, that study was done in rats with ungodly amounts of artificial sweeteners, but it's still one of those things where I say proceed with caution when it comes to artificial sweeteners. And many protein powders have artificial sweeteners in them, along with a lot of other additives. So herbal stimulants, for example, are commonly found in protein. Extra caffeine, creatine. Last I checked, nobody was sneaking any booze into protein powder, but that's about the only thing that you'll find left out of protein powder in many cases. So it all comes out to the cleanliness of the powder itself. And when you combine that with the fact that, you know, you can get some amino acids from bone broth, and, you know, if you're concerned about protein intake, you can just get yourself some nice, you know, some nice eggs from free range hens that haven't been fed a bunch of grains and corn. And you can eat some, you know, if you're concerned about food allergies or the, you know, the latest red meat scare, you can get like a really hypoallergenic meat, like a good lamb, for example, is very hypoallergenic when it comes to meat, or like a grass-fed beef. And you can use, for example, amino acids, like essential amino acids capsules, which are basically everything you'll find in a protein powder from a protein standpoint with none of the calories or the additives. And, you know, a lot of these milks out there, like goat milk, and you can combine, like, you know, almond milk and rice milk. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that you can get adequate protein without necessarily using a protein powder.
So would you recommend
that? Unless, of course, you do want your baby to get swole, in which case just use it.
So would you recommend that you don't use a protein powder while breastfeeding?
I would recommend that unless you are 100% sure it doesn't have artificial sweeteners, it's been tested for heavy metals and doesn't have additives like caffeine or any other herbal stimulants in it, that you move along and find another way to get your protein.
Hi, Ben. This is Shane. I found you through the Less Doing podcast, and I had a question on HRV. I've been testing with the Sweetbeat app for a couple of months now, and I am consistently low, at least what I think is low, somewhere between 17 and maybe up to 35 on HRV. I pegged the stress meter on the thing even when I turned the sensitivity to the lowest. So I'm trying to figure out, is there something wrong with me? What does it mean when HRV is that low? And where do I find out something specific? I sent info off to the Sweetbeat folks, and they kind of sent me a generic thing back that's not a diagnostic tool and they can't help. I'm not looking for a diagnosis. I'm looking for, you know, what does it mean when things are so low? And I'm a generally healthy person, about 43, about 160, and work out on a regular basis. So not sure what it means. Anyway, thank you very much. Love your show. Talk to you later.
That's a really low HRV, Shane. You're probably going to die.
Oh, just, Ben.
Or horribly. Amputation. That actually is a really low HRV, or heart rate variability. And first of all, if you don't know what heart rate variability is and you've never heard any of our podcasts on heart rate variability, go get yourself some self-education, because I'm not going to go over that all in this particular episode. But go to greenfieldfitnesssystems.com/naturebeat. That's greenfieldfitnesssystems.com/naturebeat. I've got all the articles and podcasts I've ever done on like HRV 101 there.
Yeah.
But when it comes to low heart rate variability or low HRV, first of all, that does not necessarily forecast impending reductions in performance. So, for example, they did a study of tennis players, and they found that after they had followed 30 days of overreaching and getting very close to overtraining by decreasing their heart rate variability quite significantly, between 15 and 50%, they actually had improved performance at the end of that program, meaning that if you are training, you can purposefully, intentionally reduce your HRV by overreaching, training yourself a little bit harder than usual. And as long as you program in smart recovery from that, that low HRV can actually come back to help you as long as you get it back up.
Interesting. So
that would be one situation in which a low HRV is a good thing. The other situation in which we actually tend to see a low HRV is in athletes who are training with a high amount of sympathetic nervous system training. And what I mean by that are like CrossFitters, sprinters, people who are doing a relatively low amount of aerobic training. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about people who are, say, like doing CrossFit and also going on a long run on the weekends and maybe another, you know, long bike ride halfway through the week. We're not talking about, you know, for example, triathletes who both weightlift and do cardio. Those would be examples of situations in which low HRV is probably just an indication of you beating yourself up too much.
Yeah.
But low HRV can also be caused by an imbalance between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system training, which is why when you turn on the TV and you see the guys in like the world's strongest man competition competing, those guys couldn't run a mile to save their lives. But they're big, they're strong, they're quite robust and healthy at what they do. And those guys are all going to have a low heart rate variability simply because they're so skewed towards sympathetic nervous system activation, towards more of like the fast twitch power strength type of training. And so if that is your, you know, your sport, you know, if that's your poison, then low heart rate variability is not something you should be too concerned about, because you want an imbalance. You want to be good at sprinting and not that great at running. It's like an interview I heard once with, I believe it was Venus Williams, who said she's very careful not to ever run more than a mile because she doesn't want a lot of slow twitch muscle fiber. She doesn't want to get slower. She doesn't need that much endurance,
you
know, theoretically, even though I would argue that being able to run 5 miles is probably going to serve you pretty well in a 4-hour tennis match. But ultimately, low HRV is not always a bad thing. It's not always a bad thing. Sometimes you want to purposefully dig yourself into that low HRV hole, and sometimes you want to, depending on your goals, have an imbalance in the type of training that you do.
And so, where can he find some specific information?
So I'll give you some more information here in a second about what to do if you don't fall into the categories that I just described, but you also have a low HRV. Because a low HRV, if it's not related to what I just described, there's a lot of things that have been associated with low HRV, such as increased risk of heart attack and other cardiac events. Mm-hmm. Coronary heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, that cluster is associated with a low HRV. People with a low HRV are at a higher risk of dying in the subsequent 3 years. So
you thought
I was joking, but I'm
really
not. I did
think you were joking.
Yeah, there's actually this study that appeared in the European Medical and Pharmacology Journal that looked at the link between heart rate variability and death due to myocardial infarction. And, show that when your HRV is consistently low, it is a sign that the ticker may need a little bit of help. So we've also seen that, like in elderly people, a high HRV is very strongly associated with longevity. And a lot of elderly people who have been tested with high HRV are relatively free of many morbidity factors. So, you know, just this morning, I posted my personal HRV that I measure each morning to the internets. Just because every once in a while I want to kind of show people, you know, what all the numbers look like if you are doing things mostly right. I know I talked about how I do lead a relatively stressful lifestyle, but my HRV is pretty good because even though I'm beating myself up with exercise stress, I have a very good combination of aerobic and anaerobic exercise. So that means my parasympathetic and my sympathetic nervous system are pretty well balanced. And my HRV is kind of high. So basically, as far as some of the best things to raise an HRV that is low, actually, even before I get into that, the kind of things that can lower an HRV, the things that I've found to have the biggest effect on lowering HRV, One would be a lack of sleep. So that would be a biggie. My heart rate variability is always lower after a bad night of sleep. Any type of excess sympathetic anaerobic training, which I already mentioned. Shallow breathing. Shallow breathing can significantly lower HRV, so you may want to check your breath patterns. Also, any type of antihistamine, right, like NyQuil or ZQuil or something like that, drops HRV extremely, extremely low. I'm not quite sure of exactly why that happens, but I'm guessing it has to do something with the effects of antihistamines on the vagus nerve. So that's another one that will lower HRV. And then the last one would just be heart disease. So you may want to listen to the episode we had a couple of weeks ago, episode 336 on heart disease, because it's possible that you may just want to go get your ticker checked out as well. So yeah. As far as what else to do, things that can raise HRV, I mean, we have a ton of resources. If you go to greenfieldfitnesssystems.com/naturebeat and check that out, because there's a lot of things that can increase HRV. Also, what you'll find is that changes of HRV related to specific pathologies. Actually, Wikipedia has a great article on heart rate variability, and they do get into some other things like liver psoriasis, diabetic neuropathy, which you could also look at as, you know, wanting to get your liver enzymes checked and checking your fasted blood glucose, because both of those can cause a reduction in HRV. And even some chiropractic issues, right? Like cervical imbalances or thoracic imbalances in your vertebra, like structural abnormalities, musculoskeletal abnormalities. Maybe just need to go get a freaking good massage, you know?
Always need a good massage.
Yeah, but I'm serious. Like, if your spine is malaligned, you may want to go see a good, like, chiropractic doc who can adjust you, or an osteopathic physician to, you know, make sure that none of that is affecting your HRV as well. A lot of things you can go after. So, you know, sometimes it takes some detective work, but I hope that helps, Shane, and opens your eyes to the wonderful, broad, sometimes confusing, but enchanting world of HRV. So there you have it. Rachel, what do you think? We do have a review this week.
It's my favorite time.
The favoritest time of the show. So this is the time of the show. I feel like we need like some kind of gentle lulling piano music. This is the time of the show when Rachel reads a review. So if you leave a review, if you go to iTunes, leave us a review, be nice. And by be nice, I mean leave 5 stars and an effing great review. And
that's the only way it gets read on the podcast.
That's right. And if you do that, then we will read your review on the podcast. And if you hear your review read, all you have to do is email gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. That's gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. And when you email said address, we will send you a sweet tech t-shirt, BPA-free water bottle, an awesome Ben Greenfield Fitness beanie, all three come in a box to your house. Make sure you let us know your t-shirt size too, because we'll send you a t-shirt. And these are sweet t-shirts. I love my t-shirt.
I want one.
My kids have baby. You don't have one?
I don't have one. I want a Team Greenfield shirt. Take photos and post it to Instagram when you're doing fun stuff, like running 24-hour Tough Mudders.
Email me after this. I'll make sure that we get you a shirt. I'll cut you a deal. I'll give you a 10% discount, Rachel.
Oh, you're so nice, Ben.
Yeah, I know. Right. Anyways, though, so what do you think? Let's hear the review.
All right, let's do it. It's by MRod31. This is by far the best health and fitness podcast out there. I've been listening to various podcasts, and they all seem to be saying the same things. Ben brings something different and has definitely opened my eyes to so many more health and fitness topics. I think what the best thing is that he actually does his research on all of the topics. Unlike some other folks who seem to try and work through the subject matter, Ben actually knows what he's talking about and doesn't miss a beat. I'm happy to have found this podcast, and Rachel is a welcome addition. Aww.
He just scored some points.
He got some serious points.
He, she, whoever was, you just scored some Rachel points, which is,
you're in.
Those are good
you're
for
in.
Something. If you ever go to Australia, there's some good Oz karma going on there. So
you want us to answer your question on the podcast? You need Rachel points.
Oh, yeah. So if you are listening in, don't turn off the show yet, because I want to tell you, this weekend's episode is going to be fantastic. You're going to learn how to regrow limbs How to Heal Stuff. What? Amazing podcast with Sean Stevenson. Crazy. And then you will not hear Rachel or I next week because we have a substitute podcast. Reason being, I am off on a week-long freediving course and will be...
Yay.
I'm going to writing a blog post about this because I am going to be experimenting with the effects of ketosis on breath-holding time and freediving performance. And I'll be writing an article on my use of MCT powders and liquid ketones during that experiment. So that will be an interesting one. Stay tuned that. Speaking of ketones, check out the groundbreaking high-fat endurance study that I just posted the link to at bengreenfieldfitness.com/338. We have a bunch of crazy interviews coming up. So don't turn off the show. Make sure you subscribe to it in iTunes. I mean, now you can turn it off because we're done, but don't turn it off permanently. So subscribe in iTunes. Tell your friends. Thanks for listening in. And I'm Ben Greenfield. She's Rachel Brown. Signing out. BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Later, Rachel.
Later, Ben.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.